Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Couture of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Sir Lawrence Freedman. Sir Lawrence is one of the leading historians dealing with the history of war. He is the author of numerous acclaimed books and is Professor Emeritus of War Studies at King's College London. And today we're discussing his latest book, Command, The Politics and Military Operations from Korea to Ukraine, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Sir Lawrence.
Good to be with you.
Sir Lawrence, what is the thesis of your book?
Well, it has a couple of purposes, and maybe one thesis. So one of the purposes was to have a means of looking at conflicts post-1945. I mean, an awful lot of military history concentrates on the First and Second World Wars, but I wanted to explore more the military history of the post-war period. Secondly, the issue of command is one that me for a long time, following from my past Christian strategy, command is the point where the strategy has to be implemented, where choices have to be made and orders given. And then the thesis, I think, is a challenge to the idea that there are separate civilian and military domains in warfare, so that the politicians are the ones who decide on the objectives, and then we must leave it to the military to meet the objectives. In practice, I think this comes over in the book, the setting of objectives has to be done with military advice and make sure that that is plausible. Equally, that when a war is being fought, you can't really expect the politicians to stay completely out of it because they're the ones who have to deal with the consequences if things go wrong. So a lot of this is about civil-military relations and how they work in practice rather than in some idealized way.
What do you mean exactly by the term command as employed in the book?
An order. The thing about it's not a request or a suggestion. It has a lot of authority behind it. It comes from the same word as mandate, the same etymology as mandate. So the advantage of command is that people should jump and do as they're told. That's what the idea conveys. And that if they don't, then they're challenging not only the specifics of the order, but the authority structure behind them. So there's something quite special about being in a position to command. And I think it goes a bit beyond that because normally we use the word not solely, but you use it to discuss military matters, where in a sense you have to command people to do things that are in a way unnatural, both in terms of being prepared to kill and being put in a position where you might get killed. So, and that's what needs the special authority an urgency, the term suggests.
How does command and how sorry, how does command operate indeed differ, if at all, in democratic states as opposed to non-democratic states?
Well, I think there's an important difference which stems from this point about authority structures. If you're an autocratic state, authoritarian state, you expect your orders to be obeyed pretty automatically, and you see dissent as a big danger if there's a way in which people are challenging your orders on a regular basis. That can seem to be very threatening. So the whole point about this sort of regime is that it depends on it depends on orders being obeyed without question. But in democratic countries, they also require military orders to be obeyed and get concerned when they're not. But at the same time, we accept that there may be room for conversations, divisions. We accept that the politics of all of our societies are more pluralistic, sometimes quite divided, and that will be reflected in the way that military operations play out. So one of the big differences in practice is that when you get right to the top, because the book doesn't just look at the general's command, it looks at the political leader's command as well. A political leader who is thinking all the time about their position and doesn't want to be challenged may end up making some pretty terrible decisions because there's nobody in the position to say that's not a very good idea. We thought about this and that to provide the challenge, whereas in democratic countries, you at least hope that there's a possibility of the challenges being made. We can all think of instances where there might have been more challenge, but nonetheless, it doesn't mean that there are opportunities to question what leaders are doing. Some would say that the advantage of authoritarian leaders is that they can take bolder decisions because they can be less transparent, and that may be true, but bold decisions aren't necessarily always the good ones.
How did General MacArthur's personality make his clash with President Truman much more likely?
Oh, I think MacArthur was what you'd call a prima donna. He felt himself to be an unassailable position. He wasn't just a general. He was a high-profile political figure who actually had hardly been in the United States for ages, but had spent his time fighting the Pacific War, mainly from Australia, and then had been put in charge of Japan, and I was then fighting the Korean War. So he just felt himself to be unassailable, very arrogant, pretty contemptuous of all politicians, and not very interested in the generality of the challenges facing American foreign policy at the start of the 1950s, when the clash came. He didn't really, and in Truman seemed him a rather nondescript person. He was a temporary occupant of the White House, but I think he saw his own role in rather grander terms.
Why exactly did President Truman dismiss MacArthur, and why were he and the Joint Chiefs of Staff so reluctant to do so?
Well, I mean, the problem was, two features of MacArthur. First, he was a high-profile political figure with a lot of support in the Republican Party. So it was clear that any time you challenged him, there was going to be some sort of political reaction. But second, he'd been pretty successful. I mean, as far as everyone was concerned, if you go to about October 1950, he first has helped stabilize the position in the Korean War, and then with the Incheon landings, has transformed the situation so that the North Koreans are the ones on the defensive. And he has the opportunity to push to the point where North Korea may cease to exist as an independent entity. The problem was he pushed too far, so that and the Joint Chiefs had worried that he was disobeying the order that had been given him, which was to avoid going to the Yalu River dividing Korea from China. So this brought China in a catastrophic way for American forces. So I think the particular issue which led to his dismissal was not actually that he failed at this critical test as a general, but was that he kept on giving speeches which dissented from American foreign policy, from the Truman administration's foreign policy. And though I think Truman saw himself as sacking McCartney just simply because of insubordination, the actual language used was that he had to leave because he didn't share the foreign policy framework of the administration. Basically, he was prepared for a war with China, which the administration didn't want.
Why did the French CNC in Indochina General Navarre make Dien Bien Phu such an important battle? Why was he so reluctant to withdraw from such an exposed position once the Viet Minh's capability to bring up heavy artillery was confirmed?
Well, it's a complex story. First problem Navarre had was though that he was a decorated and charismatic, very clever general. He didn't know Indochina very much, so he always thought he was taking advice, and those he was taking advice from weren't always impressed by him. And secondly, he was trying to work out a strategy for the French forces in Indochina at a time when the government was basically losing the will to carry on with the fight. And started to think about negotiations with the communists, and the communists understood that the logic of that was that they would need to strengthen their position for any negotiations, but Navarre never quite picked it up. The decision to make a fight of Dien Bien Phu sort of followed a previous operation that had gone relatively well for the French, whereby they picked a spot that they could defend and supply, and then after they'd beaten the communist back, then they could withdraw from it quite easily. But there was a confusion about what they were trying to do at Dien Bien Phu. Were they just trying to make a point that they could assert their presence in this part of Vietnam, or were they trying to find a way to mount offensive operations? So there was a confusion of roles which didn't help. And then there was, an underestimation of the opponent, and in particular their ability to bring artillery into position. But that wasn't confirmed until the day the battle started, although it started to be suspected. And I think the main criticism of Navarre would be that he had a basis for withdrawing before things got too difficult, or he had a basis for reinforcing, which would possibly have allowed the French to hold Dien Bien Phu, but he denied it. So he sensed that the position was not very satisfactory, and that there were vulnerabilities developing, but he didn't act on that. So then when the battle began, it soon became apparent that the French artillery position was not as superior as they'd hoped, and expected. But it wasn't too late to bring in reserves. But then he got too pessimistic about what could happen. So when there was still a chance to bring in reserves, he didn't. And then eventually, then there was no point in bringing New Zealanders. He did. Which led to a whole lot of people being killed and captured unnecessarily.
Were the French more successful militarily in Algeria than in Indochina? And if so, why?
They were militarily, they were successful in Algeria because it was easier battles for them to fight. It was closer to home. There was more of a conviction that Algeria was not just a colony, but a real part of France. The enemy had overplayed their hand by in the battle for Algeria, indulging in some basically terrorism, which created a situation in which the government turned to the Paris to deal with this challenge ruthlessly. And it was the ruthlessness of their methods that are now most notorious, but they did at the time work. They crushed the military capability of the FLN, the opposition group, that they forced the FLN to move outside of Algeria, look at Tunisia. But in a way, that was part of the problem because their opponents started to mobilize politically, rely on more on demonstrations, international support, and so on. And eventually, de Gaulle realized the French position was untenable, that you just couldn't, by military means alone, hold on to a place where the population, the bulk of the population, wanted you out, even though there were a million of settlers who very much wanted to Algeria to stay part of France. So this was an enormous crisis in American French democracy, leading to assassination attempts, attempted coups, and so on. And it's a good demonstration of the point that a military victory by itself is rarely sufficient. You need a political victory to go with it, and that's sort of what they never got in Algeria.
So that more or less is the reason why General de Gaulle decided to abandon Algérie Française.
He abandoned Algeria, yes. I mean, he got to power because of Algérie Française, but he never quite endorsed it. The thing about de Gaulle was that he knew how to stay enigmatic at all times. And when he realized that the French position just couldn't hold all the time, he moved very swiftly to open up negotiations to give Algeria independence, and this is what caused the fury amongst the settler population, but not amongst the French people generally.
How much were the tensions behind the civilians and the military, as recounted from the example of the Cuban Missile Crisis, normal in a democratic state?
I think they were quite normal. They were exaggerated to a degree because of the tense relationships between the Pentagon, the civilians in the Pentagon, led by Robert McNamara, and the military, who were pretty contemptuous in the military, generally hawkish. But again, they're not impressed either Kennedy or or McNamara with the advice that they'd been given. So the relations were pretty cool. And this was reflected in a number of exchanges that up to the announcement of the blockade and then the implementation of the blockade. All that being said, Admiral Allison, the chief of the naval operations, was in the end followed civilian control and advice. He just tried to give is commanding as much latitude as possible in leaking it. So though the episode showed all the tensions at work, in the end, the two, the civilians and the military, behaved perfectly properly towards each other when actually implementing the policy.
So in point of fact, notwithstanding these tensions, the fact of the matter was that they did not per se negatively impact either operations or policy in the crisis.
No, I don't think they did. It could have been different if the conflict had developed in other ways. It was helped that it was resolved quite quickly. But I think the general feature that struck me very much in many of the cases examined in the book, there's often possible and pick up the and heated these strong words said, because the issues matter and who cares about them. So it shouldn't be, seems to me, to be surprised or disappointed. I think sometimes it can sharp the dates lead to the positive.
Yes, please go ahead.
I don't think it's a feature of the big arguments. In the end, if you look at what the Navy did during this crisis, it managed the blockade as it had been asked to do with some sensitivity.
Is it not, in a sense, true that Ariel Sharon was a sort of Israeli MacArthur with perhaps better political antenna?
Yeah, he had some of the arrogance and self-assuredness and popular appeal of a MacArthur, and in the end was more successful politically because eventually he became not only minister in successive governments, but eventually prime minister. So he had that success. But on the other hand, his political judgment on the big issues was often wanting. He was a brilliant tactical operational general. He had the loyalty of his men. He was very audacious, imaginative, brave in the decisions he took, but he was chronically insubordinate, always challenging those above him, politically or militarily. And of course, in the 1973 war, you have this odd feature that he actually was called back to be a divisional commander after as a reservist, having just started a new political party, Likud, in opposition to the Labour governing party, and this hampered his relations all the way through the war. So it's a very particular case, Sharon. When eventually he was able to design and lead a major operation himself, which is to be led to invasion of Lebanon, it was catastrophic. Overestimated what the Christian Maronites would do for Israel. Didn't really understand the Lebanon as a country, and that led to a catastrophic result, which I think we're dealing with the consequences of that to this day. That's what led to the rise of Hezbollah, for example. So Sharon is, again, a good example of somebody who's militarily very astute, but politically, at least in all the real matters, a very poor judgment.
How would you characterize President Nixon's relations with the Pentagon, and how did it influence policy during North Vietnam's Easter Offensive of 1972?
Well, Nixon's relations along with everybody was characterized by suspicion and secrecy and and his own sort of difficulty in relating to these people. So he didn't trust the Pentagon. He thought it had, he didn't trust Malvin Laird, who was the Secretary of Defense, and was always seeing plots and insubordination. And that was also compounded by a real policy difference. So when the North Vietnamese mounted their invasion of South Vietnam, his generals wanted to concentrate very much on using air power, the available air power, to defeat the invading forces, to attack those that were coming out at their defences, whereas Nixon wanted to use them to attack the Hanoi and eventually Haiphong, the big North Vietnamese cities, to coerce them, in fact, into a peace deal, to give the Paris peace talks some impetus, which he did, although the deal was didn't accomplish all that he would have wished it to accomplish. So what's interesting is that the personality factors and political factors here, which in a way poison the relationships and lead to the suspicion. But behind it all, there was a very big strategic question, which is how do you use your air power to the greatest effectiveness when you're both trying to stop an army on the march and trying to coerce the enemy's capital to change their policy. So and eventually, the president, he got his way. So you have the bombing of Hanoi and Haiphong, the mining of Haiphong as well. So it was, and that was possible because actually after a while, there was enough air power around to meet both the immediate demands of stopping the invasion and the longer-term demands of coercive policies.
Would it be true to say that in all the conflicts examined in the book, that the Falklands War had the most harmonious civil-military interaction?
It was pretty harmonious. There were tensions in the command relationships, but these were largely at the front end in the South Atlantic. In London, you had a situation where the Prime Minister, who had no military experience, was quite alone in some ways, didn't have sort of the large stature that the American president has, supporting him at all times, and was very reliant on military advice. I actually got on very well with the senior military advisors, particularly Admiral Sir Terence Lewin, who was Chief of Defence Staff, who had a good personal relationship with her, and she came to trust his judgment. She was, fortunately for her, fortunately, I guess, for the UK, he had quite a shrewd sense of the politics of the situation, as well as the military requirements. And because he was an admiral himself, he understood the naval operations that were going on. Whereas if it had been more of an army operation, he might have had to defer to others more. So I think it was quite harmonious. It worked quite well, although there were that meant that the relations between, if you like, London and the South Atlantic sometimes got a bit strained because they into the South Atlantic itself, they didn't quite understand why they were being asked to do what they were being asked to do.
Why was the Russian campaign in the first Chechen War so abysmal, and why was the campaign in the second war so much better, militarily speaking?
Well, I mean, the Russian army in the mid-90s was just in a terrible state. Russian society, economy, politics was in a pretty dire position. There wasn't enough money around. People were demoralized. The military were demoralized. They weren't being paid properly. The conscripts weren't healthy. And again, you have the standard problem of underestimating the opponent. In this case, were perfectly well prepared for the military when they came to them. So the thing got off to a bad start from day one, and was never really seen to be worth the effort that had been that was going into defeating the Chechen rebels. And eventually, you even would have to argue that if it was a victory for the rebels in Chechnya, Putin's war, first war, had any features that didn't particularly reflect well on the competence of the Russian army. But there were two aspects that were more effective. First, the readiness was pretty brutal. And the battles for Grozny, the song of Chechnya, and secondly, a divided rule policy. So they found Chechens that were able to work with Russia, as well as those who were adamantly opposed. So it was by this time the Russians' state was knit together, it was more competent, but it was also more ruthless in some ways, and more astute in making sure that it didn't face a united Chechen opposition.
Is Putin's war in Ukraine merely another example of a military exercise similar to the first Chechen war? And why did the Russian military agree to such an abysmal operational plan in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. I think, again, you have the same problem of total underestimation of the opponent, and not just that they're not as capable militarily as the Russians, but also the Ukraine was not even a proper state, that it lacked the capacity to fight, the government was illegitimate, that there were inherent divisions between the West and the Eastern country, and so on. So the whole operation, now talking about the invasion of 2022, but it goes back to the first attempts to destabilize Ukraine as well. The whole thing was launched on a poor assessment of why Ukraine would fight and how it would fight. When things went wrong, as they did from day one of the Russian military operation, they were never really able to recover their position. So things carried on going wrong. And they still have yet to go right for Russia.
Why was General... I'm sorry. What explains the fraught relations between NATO head General Wesley Clark and his superiors in the Pentagon, and how, if at all, did that affect policy and strategy operations during the Kosovo War?
Well, I mean, part of the problem lies with the fact of the position of the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, which is obviously a position first established by General Eisenhower, it's a dual role. On the one hand, you're the leader of American forces in Europe, American army in Europe, and sector answerable directly to the Pentagon. On the other hand, you're NATO's senior general. In that role, you have to work with the NATO Secretary General and all the other members of the alliance. And Clark was far more committed to a very sort of forward policy, an active policy in Kosovo, than his superiors in the Pentagon, who were worried that this was something that the United States shouldn't really be doing, and if it really had to do it, it should be very much a sort of limited liability. Whereas Clark's view was that once you were in there, you had to make sure you won, and that is necessary. And the big arguments on that, as it developed, was how much you deployed the threat to use land forces rather than just rely on air forces. And on that, Clark was probably closer to the UK Prime Minister Tony Blair than he was to President Clinton in the US. So there were inherent tensions, and that partly this is again comes down to personalities. Whereas Clark is quite a cerebral general, very well educated, perfectly brave. I mean, he'd had his time in Vietnam, but was not seen by the Joint Chiefs as being as one of them. He was seen as being a bit arrogant and distant. So the personality factors contributed again to policy differences. But most of these times when you see that, there's an underlying question of strategy involved, and it's not just the fact that these guys don't get on. But the command arrangements were incredibly complicated, and this certainly didn't help.
Why was General Clark at loggerheads with General Sir Michael Jackson?
Oh, well, that's a particular incident. When Milosevic, the Serb leader, eventually capitulated for a variety of reasons, a peacekeeping force was supposed to go in, which General Jackson had been preparing for NATO, and it was sitting in Macedonia. And the Russians who had support, I mean, were naturally supportive of Milosevic, although in the end they'd helped to put the pressure on him, thought that they could reassert their position in authority by taking Pristina Airport first, and in the sense using that to potentially divide Kosovo, maybe lead to a partition. And Clark correctly, I think, saw that's what the Russians were up to. But Jackson believed that he could handle it without having to be very desperately confrontational with the Russians, which indeed, you know, he was able to do. But he was mainly helped by the fact that Clark had encouraged the other NATO countries not to let Russian aircraft fly over their territories, bringing in troops to Pristina Airport. So actually, the Russian units that went there were rather stranded. That's how the crisis was defused. But again, tired people working at different time zones, trying to sort out what was going on, ended up shouting at each other quite a lot, with Jackson famously saying he wasn't going to start World War III for Clark. And Jackson also used his dual appointment, both as a British general and as a NATO general, to give himself more latitude.
Who do you assign major responsibility for the failure to capture and or kill bin Laden in the mountains of Tora Bora in 2001?
Bin Laden prepared Tora Bora as a sort of redoubt, as a place to escape to. And when it was clear that the Taliban were going to lose and that coalition forces and the Northern Alliance were sweeping in, he moved there. The basic problem was that in the defeat of the Taliban, the Americans had managed to work very closely with Afghans, who had their own agenda, their own reasons for defeating the Taliban, not least to provide the government of the country. Whereas in Tora Bora, there wasn't the same sort of quality of Afghan alliance. The so-called Eastern Alliance was very cobbled together. Lots of internal divisions. They're not very fitted to what the Americans were trying to do. And so when it was apparent that the Bin Laden was there, they were not particularly keen at taking great risks themselves. Yet the American military weren't also prepared to take great risks. And you have a very particular issue arising where General Franks, the American central commander, was pretty wary about General Mattis and his Marines, who was the only force in a position to get in numbers to Tora Bora, where they might be able to cut him off and stop him getting to Pakistan, which is where eventually he ended up. So I think you just had an operation that was led in a rather erratic way, with the CIA taking a lot of the early initiative, calling in airstrikes, which alerted Bin Laden and his followers to the risk, but didn't actually take them out. And the whole thing ended up with Bin Laden escaping, and lots of his Al Qaeda people were killed, but not Bin Laden. That came much later.
What explains the failures of the British occupation of Basra in the Iraq War?
Well, there are a number of explanations for the failure in Basra. I think the basic problem was that the British Army were never really committed to staying for long in Iraq after the 2003 war. They wanted to be part of the big operation to show that they could play a role. They performed perfectly effectively in 2003, but then found themselves in occupying power and found themselves in charge of the area around Basra. I think then they were a bit complacent because it's largely a Shia area, and they thought would be more sympathetic to the British. But what they did was allow the extremist militias to take over, including taking over the police force, effectively. And so their own position became quite vulnerable. They didn't have the numbers or the strength or the resources to make a big impact, so they, in a way, just got stranded in the air. Mutad al-Sadr, the Shia leader, turned on them or wanted to show them who's boss. They didn't have much of a response and ended up having to do a deal with the militia in order to extract their forces from their most vulnerable positions. So it's basically they lost, over time, they lost their ability to impose their presence and lost control, and conceded it to militias. It wasn't really until the Iraqi government was prepared to take them on that the situation improved.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Sir Lawrence, what would it be?
That all military operations have to be understood in the political context. I mean, without denying for a second the importance of professionalism in the military, the technologies and the logistics and all those things which really do make a difference. In the end, you need to be able to work with the government to have realistic political objectives and to know strategically when the objectives may have to be changed because the circumstances have changed, or to have an honest appreciation of what has to be done to meet them. So it really is about the importance of understanding the political context of military operations.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Sir Lawrence, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to a podcast on the New Books Network, New Books in History. Thank you again, Sir Lawrence, very much.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.